Welcome to MTSU on the Record. I'm Jenna Logue, and we're coming to you from the historic Tom Jackson Building on the campus of Middle Tennessee State University in Murfreesboro, Tennessee. Our guest today is this year's Strickland Lecturer at MTSU, Dr. Thomas J. Segrue.
He will conduct an address here at 6 p.m. Tuesday, September 24th, in the State Farm Lecture Hall of MTSU's Business and Aerospace Building.
Dr. Segrue is the David Boies Professor of History and Sociology and Director of the Penn Social Science and Policy Forum at the University of Pennsylvania. He specializes in 20th century American politics, urban history, civil rights, and race. His most recent book is Not Even Past, Barack Obama and the Burden of Race in 2010. Race, Inequality, and Diversity in Obama's America will be the topic of his speech. We'll speak with Dr. Segrue in just a moment via telephone after these words from MTSUnews.com.
Here are some of the stories now on MTSUnews.com, the university's news and information website. The Tennessee Dairy Products Association processors presented former MTSU Farm Lab Director Tim Redd with a Distinguished Service Award for his 32 years of leadership and service to the dairy industry through his work at the university. The award was presented September 6th at the Tennessee State Fair in Nashville. Whitney Dix, a pilot and dispatch manager with Southwest Airlines, is spearheading a scholarship drive in memory of Shonda Carney Fanning, the UPS pilot who perished in a plane crash in Birmingham August 14th. Fanning earned her bachelor's degree in aerospace administration from MTSU in 99. And recording industry chair Beverly Keel has created an award for outstanding department contributions in honor of Professor Emerita Marilyn Wood. One deserving faculty member or staffer will receive $1,000 each April in gratitude for his or her contributions to the department. For MTSU News at any time, go to MTSUnews.com.
Speaking with us by phone from his home in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, now is Dr. Thomas J. Segrue, this year's Strickland Lecturer at MTSU. Welcome and thanks for being with us today.
Oh, thanks for having me. It's nice to be here.
Dr. Segrue, it has been said of both Barack Obama, the candidate, and Barack Obama, the president, that he has had to avoid the appearance of being an angry black man, lest he frighten away whites who might be supportive or at least benign. First of all, do you concur with that analysis? And if so, is that a conscientious effort on his part, or is it part of the nature of this particular individual?
I don't think that Obama has very much anger in him at all. He's one of the most unflappable, level-headed, and consistent politicians who I've studied as an American political historian. So the idea on the part of some of his supporters that he's just holding back, and if given the chance, he'll express his righteous indignation, or the idea among some of his critics that he is a bitter, angry black radical waiting to explode. Both of those, I think, are fundamental misreadings of his history and his current politics.
What does it say about us as a society that we would seek to judge America's first black president in terms of either extreme?
Well, I think it's a reminder of how despite the fact that many have talked about America entering a post-racial moment or a post-racial age or a post-civil rights era, it's a reminder of how deep the divisions over race and politics remain in the United States right up to the present day. And so I think the perception of Obama, the reading of his comments on race one way or another are, the projections of people's hopes that Obama is really a civil rights activist, dressed as a president, or fears that somehow Barack Obama is a polarizing figure who's going to play on and exacerbate deep-rooted divisions and divides in America. I think in some ways it's a reminder of how, despite the fact that we've overcome a lot since the civil rights era, there are still ways in which racial conflict and tensions are still barely beneath the surface in the United States.
Obama delivered what I thought was one of his most incisive orations in Philadelphia on the subject of race in American history, and I was rather taken aback by some of the criticism he caught for it, when in fact some of the more explicit things that he said about our long national conundrum were just actually historical facts. What was your take on the Philadelphia speech?
The Philadelphia speech was in some ways classic Obama. That is, he offered a very carefully reasoned and historically accurate view of, you know, race and civil rights in the American past, but he did so in a way that attempted to speak to the concerns of everyone listening. So to African American listeners, he expressed sympathy with the persistence of racial discrimination in the United States. To whites, he expressed appreciation for the distance that they've traveled on questions of race over time. To conservatives, he talked about the necessity of individual self-help and personal responsibility. To liberals, he talked about the need to address pressing economic problems, joblessness, and economic insecurity. And so in many ways, I mean, you could listen to Barack Obama's speech coming from any number of different political vantage points and find parts of it that spoke directly to you. He spoke in religious terms, building on a long tradition in civil rights as well. So in many ways, the reaction to Obama's speech was as much folks projecting onto him their own political agendas and concerns, because, you know, in many respects, it was a carefully crafted speech designed to take a middle ground, respecting differences and trying to find commonality among the electorate. And, you know, I think most of the folks who listened to that speech, other than, you know, really harsh critics, did hear a call for reconciliation rather than a call for division. And you know, I think the speech, probably more than any other major address that Obama gave in that year, really bolstered his political prospects and candidacy.
How would you analyze Obama's rhetorical style? It's very deliberate, and yet at the same time, he has shown in certain campaign appearances and certain presidential appearances that he can channel the black church motif of Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King and others, but it's not his major motif in speaking.
It's Obama is someone who is very careful with the language that he chooses. He very seldom goes off script. That is, speaking off the cuff, saying things that might alienate those who are listening. In fact, you know, we can remember pretty easily when he's gone off script because he does it so seldom. On the other hand, I mean, think about many of our most recent presidents. You know, President Reagan, President Clinton, both President Bushes, they often went off script. They often said things that proved to be politically fraught or complicated afterwards. Obama, by contrast, so seldom goes off script that we can remember almost to the event when he did. For example, during the campaign, making the off-the-cuff comment that some white voters were bitter and clinging to their guns, a comment that he made to a Democratic Party fundraiser in California, or his comment about the arrest of Harvard professor Henry Louis Gates outside of his house by the Cambridge police, and his expression of concern and sympathy for Gates, who's someone that Obama knew personally. We remember those because they were deviations from what's, you know, a very cautious approach that he's taken to these issues in almost every major public address over time. Obama is a politician. King was a prophet. Obama says things to try to win over diverse constituencies and win political support. Martin Luther King Jr., on the other hand, told it like it was, including making proclamations that were very unpopular. It's important to remember in the 1960s that most Americans, especially white Americans, were deeply skeptical of the Reverend King. They saw him as a radical. They saw him as dangerous. They saw him as someone who was trying to overthrow a system that they thought worked perfectly fine. It's very seldom that you'll hear President Obama taking a risky or prophetic position. And actually, on many political issues, I suspect that the Reverend King and President Obama would not see eye to eye.
This is MTSU on the record.
The Concrete Industry Management Program at MTSU fills the need for trained personnel who know concrete technology and techniques. Our alumni go into the marketplace grounded in basic math and science and able to promote products or services related to the industry. Our participation in the Academic Common Market ensures talented students in other states a chance to enroll on an in-state tuition basis. This is Dr. Heather Brown, Director of the program.
To find out more information on this or other university programs, visit mtsunews.com.
We're talking via telephone from Philadelphia with Dr. Thomas J. Segru, the Strickland Lecturer at MTSU. He'll be talking here at 6 p.m. Tuesday, September 24th in the State Farm Lecture Hall of the Business and Aerospace Building. What do you think, Dr. Segru, that we as a nation got out of the recent celebration of the 50th anniversary of the March on Washington? Have we forgotten because of the eloquence of King's I Have a Dream speech that it was also called a March for Jobs and Freedom?
Oh, definitely. The March on Washington and Reverend King's speech have become classics in American political oratory. We remember King's reference to the mountaintop, his discussion of dreams, and that becomes part of school curricula. You know, my children, when they were in elementary school, were asked to do an exercise on what dreams they have, building off of Reverend King's dreams. But King, in 1963, and the folks participating in the March in Washington, were calling for pushing hard on Congress and on the president to enact what would become the Civil Rights Act of 1964. They offered a very harsh critique of persistent discrimination and inequality in the United States. The Reverend King himself talked about what he called the magnificent new militancy of African Americans in the United States in 1963, at a moment when many, including President Kennedy and many of his advisors and many in Congress and large parts of the general public were calling on King and the civil rights movement to slow down, to not demand so much, to accept the situation and move very cautiously and gradually toward change. And King and those gathered in Washington on that August day didn't have any of that. They wanted and knew that change would only come if they really put pressure on the political system.
What sort of a trail do you think Barack Obama has blazed for African Americans who might consider following in his path, such as Newark Mayor Cory Booker, for example?
Well, I think President Obama is one of a generation of African American politicians that includes Cory Booker, who have fashioned a politics that revolves around building interracial coalitions, winning electorate, winning votes among a majority white or at least a non-African American electorate. They differ very much from the first generation of black politicians who often rose to power representing predominantly black constituencies, say black mayors or city council people who represent predominantly black districts. I see other parallels to Barack Obama. Senator Edward Brooke, the first African-American U.S. senator, he was a Republican from Massachusetts, was elected in the 1960s, and Governor Douglas Wilder from Virginia was elected in the late 1980s and won in a he was a Democrat who won in a state that's often perceived as a red state, certainly at that time, and won the vote of a majority of whites. Or Harvey Gantt, who was mayor of Charlotte, North Carolina, also elected in the 1980s in a majority white city. These are all elected officials who took a different path than many who came of age in the civil rights era by forging interracial coalitions, by playing to the political center. Gantt, Wilder, Edward Brooke, Barack Obama are all very much centrists who believed in kind of appealing to the broadest segment of independent voters as well as voters in their party and enough voters from the other party to put them over the top. And so I think that makes them very distinctive in American political history compared to, say, Mayor Coleman Young of Detroit, or who was elected in the 1970s, or Mayor Sharp of Newark, New Jersey, who was elected in the 1970s, both of whom really, who won in majority African-American cities and did so by appealing to group pride.
We'll take another break here. We'll be right back. This is MTSU on the Record.
The MTSU Department of Art has the newest facility for visual arts in the state, with approximately 50,000 square feet of space, including high-tech computers and computer-driven equipment for multimedia, graphic design, printmaking, sculpture, painting, and ceramics. We feature a visiting artist lecture program and an exhibition program that exposes students to work by national and international artists. This is Jean Nagy, Chair of the Department of Art.
To find out more, visit mtsunews.com.
We're talking to Dr. Tom Segrew via telephone from Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. He is the Strickland Lecturer at MTSU. Dr. Segrew, you've also written a book about what you call the forgotten struggle for civil rights in the North. And I can remember during the Boston busing battles in the 70s, hearing Southerners say, finally, the Northerners are getting some attention from the media for being just as racist as some Southerners are. Why has Northern racism been less apparent?
Yeah, well, when I wrote my book, Sweet Land of Liberty, which was on the forgotten struggle for civil rights in the North, I had been studying the history of the North for a really long time, and hardly anybody wrote about civil rights history there. The assumption in academia, in popular culture, in films, is that racism and the struggle against it was a distinctively Southern issue. It grew out of the system of plantation slavery and Jim Crow thereafter. And there's no denying that history. But by focusing overwhelmingly on the South, Northerners and many of the folks writing and producing the history of race and civil rights in the United States came from the North, overlooked what was happening in their own backyards. It was close to home. It was painful. It often didn't manifest in exactly the same ways, although when I wrote the history of the North, I found a lot more commonalities than I expected to find when I began writing the book. For example, segregated movie theaters, segregated restaurants, segregated swimming pools. In the North, all the way through the 1940s, pretty much everywhere, and in many places well into the 50s and 60s. So what we think of as a distinctively Southern practice of racial segregation in public accommodations and public places was just as commonplace in the North.
Do you remember the battles over the use of busing to achieve a racial balance in major urban areas, but also, most prominently in Boston? I can remember, people standing outside and banging on the buses. I thought, my God, this is reminiscent of what the Freedom Riders went through in a way.
Absolutely. I mean, in Boston, there were, violent attacks on the first African-American kids to be put on buses into predominantly white neighborhoods. But, Pontiac, Michigan, a suburb of Detroit, folks broke into the school bus depot and destroyed a whole bunch of school buses to try to protest against and prevent school desegregation there. And I could go on. I mean, the North ended up in some ways more intensely resisting school desegregation in the 1970s than its counterparts in the South. And to a great extent, those battles against school integration were successful. The most segregated school districts in the United States are almost all in the North today. The states with the highest rates of segregation in public education include places we think of as being pretty progressive on questions of race, like New York or Michigan or Barack Obama's home state of Illinois. These are places with very high rates of segregation in public education and segregation in housing, which go hand in hand. And so the Northern story, in other words, is a really important history in understanding the development and past and present of race and civil rights in the United States.
This year, in addition to being the 50th anniversary of the March on Washington, also marks the 150th anniversary of the Civil War. Have you noticed any tendencies about the observance of that landmark that give you pause as an historian or cause to cheer as an historian?
Well, as a historian, I've been impressed at how widely and often how intelligently the history of the Civil War has been covered by the major news media and various online sites. I mean, there's a lot of romanticism and a lot of misinformation about the Civil War, but still, you can go, for example, to the websites of the Washington Post or the New York Times, and they've commissioned military historians, historians of slavery, historians of the South, historians of virtually every aspect of life in the Civil War to write essays for them, and they've been really eye-opening, really smart. They've commissioned not just the kind of famous kind of celebrity historians, but often, you know, young historians who are writing their first book on an important battle or on a legislative controversy. And, you know, I would also say that some of the popular culture reflections on the Civil War have been pretty good. I mean, there were lots of debates about the historical accuracy of Steven Spielberg's film on Abraham Lincoln, but compared to a lot of the previous generation of popular representations of the Civil War, it was pretty good. So overall, I would say, as a historian, I'm pretty happy at the coverage that anniversary has been getting.
We'll pause one more time. We'll be right back. This is MTSU on the Record.
The Middle East Center at MTSU seeks to promote greater understanding of the politics, history, and culture of this vitally important region of the world. Its mission includes the promotion of outreach programs and faculty research. The center sponsors lectures by Middle East experts and scholarly exchanges. We're especially pleased to offer a new interdisciplinary minor in Middle East Studies with courses in Arabic and Hebrew. This is Dr. Alan Hibbard, Center Director.
For all the latest MTSU information, go to mtsunews.com.
In our final moments with Dr. Thomas Sugru, our Strickland lecturer this year, Dr. Sugru, do you have any thoughts on how the teaching of American history as regards race should and could change at either the K-12 level or in higher education? What changes would you like to see implemented?
Oh, I think there's a lot of room for improvement. We tend to tell a story of heroes and a story of victories, and it's important in the history of civil rights to celebrate the heroes, the martyrs, the activists who put their life on the line and who often made great sacrifices to accomplish the civil rights victories of the 1950s and 1960s especially. But it's too easy for us to get into a celebratory mode and overlook the unfinished business of the civil rights era. That is, while we've overcome, to use the Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. and the Southern Freedom Struggle's famous expression, you know, we shall overcome. While we have overcome in key respects, there are many arenas in which we still have very deep racial divisions, separation, and inequality in the United States. And so we can't be too celebratory. We also need to take account of where the civil rights struggle didn't achieve the goals it set out to achieve, and to think about the ways that we can move forward. We also need to remember that, and my students, I think, are pretty typical of young people looking back on the history of the civil rights movement. Pretty much all of them say, oh, yeah, if I had been alive in 1955, I would have supported the Montgomery bus boycott. Or if I had been in Birmingham, Alabama in 1963, I would have been out there on the streets facing down those police dogs and fire hoses. Or I would have been to the March on Washington in August of 1963 with the 250,000 or so people calling for jobs and freedom. The reality is most Americans, especially white Americans, were indifferent at best, hostile at worst to the goals of what we now consider to be the mainstream civil rights movement, including the Reverend King. And so when we tell the histories of that period, I think it's important for us to remember how unpopular the movement was and its goals were, and we need to celebrate the fact that that movement put a lot of pressure on the system and, you know, accomplish some of the most significant pieces of legislation in American history. But we also need to remind ourselves that they face some real uphill battles, and not just pat ourselves on the back and celebrate the fact that the civil rights movement was victorious and we moved past.
It was even difficult for some young African Americans of the 50s and 60s to throw themselves wholeheartedly into the civil rights movement because, for one thing, their parents had to be so cautious to make every small increment of progress they'd ever made. They didn't want their children to get hurt physically, financially, or in any other way.
Oh, that's right. When you read the biographies or autobiographies of many African-American activists in the civil rights struggle, many of them, had conflicts with their parents. I think of, for example, John Lewis, who's now a U.S. Congressman from Georgia, who got his start as a college and theology student in Nashville. He was a part of the sit-in movement in Nashville. He joined the Freedom Rides. He was at the March on Washington and gave a speech. He's one of the most important figures in the history of civil rights in the United States. But his parents were adamantly opposed to him putting his body on the line. In part, they saw their son as someone who could make it. He could escape the hard scrabble life that they had lived on their, as farmers, basically. They believed that he was jeopardizing his future by joining protests. And they were also very law-abiding, and they worried that getting arrested and committing civil disobedience was counterproductive, given their view of the law. So then there are a whole bunch of civil rights activists in that period who had similar generational conflicts over the strategies and what they were doing.
We are grateful to have had the privilege of speaking with Dr. Thomas Segrew, this year's Strickland Lecturer here at MTSU. He'll be speaking at 6 p.m. Tuesday, September 24th, in the State Farm Lecture Hall of MTSU's Business and Aerospace Building. Dr. Segrew, thank you so much for being our guest on MTSU On the Record.
Thanks for having me.
MTSU On the Record, a news and information program about Middle Tennessee State University, is produced by the university's Marketing and Communications Office, which is solely responsible for its content. Read more about MTSU at our website, mtsunews.com. Podcasts of this program are available at mtsunews.com and on iTunes.